Well, the South Summit School Board met last week in the studio with a recap of some of the items discussed there. I have Superintendent Shad Sorensen. He's joined by Assistant High School Principal and Activities Director Shad Stevens. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Superintendent, let's start with you. I saw the slick four-page mailing outlining your growth, the concerns, and possible solutions. So was this published and paid for by the district?
It was. As a district, we have a responsibility to educate our citizens and our stakeholders. And our role is not to persuade, but to inform. And one of the things that we learned from our previous bond is that we relied very heavily on social media and online resources. And as we've talked to people, they didn't feel that they had the facts and they wanted information in their hands. And so this is the first of probably two or three mailers that we will do in addition to online information.
Yeah, where's that fine line, though? I mean, in terms of informational and, of course, with the bond election planned, you know, kind of, you know, tipping that line, you know, to be in support of, you know, the bond election.
Right. We did a thorough review of this before publishing it, and what we wanted to make sure is that every statement that we listed was actual factual. And we have been in contact, of course, with the Attorney General's office, etc., because there has been concern in the past of districts overstepping that line, and we do not want to do that. We just want to make sure our constituents have the information that they need to make the informed choice.
Okay, so this basically went out to every property tax owner in South Summit School District, huh?
Yes, it did.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit about the status of the upcoming bond. Has the school board decided on a figure for that?
We have not. We did have a meeting with Zions Public Finance. They attended the last board meeting, and they shared with us some positives and some negatives as we are going into this bond. The first thing that is interesting, in 2017, interest was 3.09. It currently has dropped to 3.03. So that is in our favor. That is a positive. Also, the district valuation has increased from $1.8 billion to $1.9. The drawback is the cost of construction. And some of the prices that are being bid on schools is $315 a square foot, which is crazy. I was talking to a superintendent that just opened a new high school this year out in the basin, and they were down in the, I think, 180s or something. And so it has significantly changed in a couple years, and that is concerning to us as well. And the median home price has increased from $310,000 to $438,000 in the 2 years in our district.
Yeah, so even though we may have some cost savings on interest, we've got higher property values, meaning that the taxes would be higher than what you thought?
Absolutely. In comparison to the 2 years ago, it's going to be significantly more expensive to do the same thing that we were proposing.
So is the plan to bond just for a new high school?
Yes, we have other needs, as it identifies, with the capital projects, etc., and working towards addressing the growth of Silver Summit. But the hope is that the bond would cover the high school, and if we could, it would be nice if construction prices decreased to cover some of those capital projects, but the remainder of the capital projects and other growth issues would need to come from capital funds.
So even if the bond was approved in November, you don't go out to sell those bonds till maybe this time next year, huh?
Depending on how far we are into the process, we would possibly be selling those in December and January of next year. We're told that that's oftentimes the best, at least it is for the construction prices, and so our hope would be that if the bond passes in November, we are able to put out the bids in December and January and get those in and get moving forward for spring construction.
So as you look at these other capital needs, I mean, how do you pay for the plans then to convert the high school into the middle school and the middle school into the grades 3 to 5 and the elementary school into pre-K through second grade?
As we've talked in the past, we do have some resources in our current capital budget, but not enough to cover all of those projects, and so we would have to incrementally do it as the funds are available.
So you go, phase one, you've completed. Phase two goes through 2025. In terms of phase three, I mean, are we talking even after that?
Phase three would probably kick in at 2025, and a lot of it just really depends on the growth.
Yeah.
We wish we had that magic prediction, but...
So does this mean that the master planning that you've gone through is complete?
So this is the board's master plan, their vision of what they project to address growth in the district.
Okay, but we don't know what those future dates are. It just really depends on what you see in terms of growth?
Correct.
All right.
And where the growth actually happens.
Yeah. Let's see, you're now working on the schematic design for the new high school. How do you expect that will change from what we have currently? I mean, we hear about the need for flexible learning spaces.
And Mr. Stevens can address this as well. We've had opportunities where we have brought in our administration and we've received input from the faculty on the needs of the school. We provide that to the architect and they start looking at square footage and what can be flexible learning space and what needs to be fixed learning space. And we're really trying to vision for the future and not build a school that was yesterday's school, but build a school for 21st century learning.
Yeah, so Principal Stevens, how are you, I mean, how are you going about this? I mean, just looking what's happening across the country, across the world in terms of learning space?
Yeah, absolutely. So all of us that are on, that have come together to talk about this are bringing, you know, past experience and educational information that we've all gained from different, you know, different things we've observed. And so it's just a matter of coming together in many conversations with teachers, administrations, considering what is working now and what needs to be changed according to the trainings that, you know, all of us go to seminars and things and experience. You know, I recently came back from a training in Texas where I was able to collaborate with other, you know, educators from around the country. And these were a lot of the conversations we were having regarding facilities and what, you know, what's working, what's not working, what do we need to do to adjust. And we're trying to consolidate, consider our current spaces, what's effective in regards to office space, what do we need for effective learning spaces, how big a space, where can we best utilize that. And those are daily conversations that we're having, you know, as administration and teachers with a district office as well. So it's exciting as we consider our needs and what could be there for the learning of our students.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, too. I mean, we've basically kept the same paradigm that we've had since, like, public schools opened, right?
Right.
You know, a classroom with a teacher in front.
Right.
And so in terms of what we should expect to see, I mean, teachers would move from room to room. I mean, they wouldn't have necessarily their classroom or...
You know, and there's two different ways to look at it, because I've been in both types of schools where it's more of a college campus style, basically, where teachers are able to rotate. There's no set rooms. As teachers are able to move around, it provides that flexible space for scheduling, because that's always one of the challenges is the scheduling. It's a very large Rubik's cubes trying to get classes and where they need to be for students. But that's definitely one of the considerations and options, is making it more of a college style where teachers maybe have an office space separate, a collaborative space where they can work together during their prep hours or downtime, and they can align their assessments and things of that nature and have a space to do that. Where being in the classroom, it's more of an open, clear environment where, you know, any class, any teacher can be in that space.
Yeah. And when we talk about just kind of the styles of education, we know we hear a lot about blended learning, I think, like what we're seeing at the South Summit Academy, right? So a little bit of teacher, a lot of work just being done by students themselves. So we just need a place for students to at least have some quiet space, I
Absolutely.
Guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, that needs to be part of it as well. It is a challenge, though, as you consider the resources and the teachers need, the teaching things that they have, being able to move as well, because basically that type of style puts all the teachers with their supplies on carts and moving. So we have to consider storage space and the resources that they need for the different teaching, like computer labs. You know, that's obviously, there'd be different things that could make that work, and some of them couldn't, so...
Yeah, so how far do you take this design phase in terms of, I mean, do you have to wait, or are you ready to go with a school by November when people vote?
Absolutely. Our hope is that what we take to the public in November, they know what they are buying. So they've seen schematic drawings of the outside, they know what the rooms will look like, and that we're ready to take that as quickly as possible to RFP for contractors after the bond passes.
Yeah. And then how do you deal with future growth? I mean, is it you just build it in wings?
So the school will be built for 750 students. So we anticipate that will be adequate for at least 10 years. And then it will be designed to be able to have future growth with wings.
Okay. And this is being built on the western side of Camas. You have how many acres there?
Oh, 150 something.
Yeah. And some of it, but not all of it is developable, right?
Correct. We've gone through the process with hiring our consultant who's worked with the Corps of Engineers, but the bulk of the property is developable, and we have all of that in place, and now we're working with the engineers to put the buildings exactly where they should be so that they're stable and that it's in the right place with the property.
Yeah, because I think there was some concern that there were wetlands there, and so you would need what Army Corps of Engineer approval to...
Correct, and we've worked through that process, and the Army Corps has not signed off on where the buildings will be, but they have signed off on what is permanent designated wetlands and what have been created by irrigation.
Okay. As I mentioned in the introduction, Mr. Stevens, you're also the chair of the District Safety Coordination Committee. What does this committee do?
So obviously we review the safety of our students and our buildings, our facilities, in regards to any, you know, of our emergency response policies, procedures, and consider what needs to be adjusted, and provides training and, you know, as we provide training for our teachers and our students how to respond to these types of situations.
Yeah, and that's right. I mean, didn't have to do that 10 years ago, but
right.
Can you talk a little bit about the trainings that take place? I mean, both for faculty and the students?
Absolutely. So a lot of the trainings and the development, the dynamics of what's been happening around the country, obviously with the active shooter has risen up to the highest of priorities in regards to, it used to be fires and fire drills, you know, where you have those consistently and everybody does their fire drills, but it's been probably over 50 years since we've lost a student in a school fire. It's been many, many years since we've had one of those. So the dynamics of the training and the focus of what we need to prepare for as school faculty and staff has shifted to more of an active shooter intruder type situation. So we do, just recently we've done a training where we've invited a gentleman by the name of David Costa who comes in and he focuses on helping teachers prepare to respond to situations. And so they prepare, they prevent, and then if need so, they protect, you know, in a situation. So it's a mindset training that we send our teachers through. He's come twice now where we've done multiple hour trainings, making them aware mentally how to set up a classroom, what to be aware for, how to interact with students, what signs to kind of notice, you know, with students so that they can prepare for and hopefully prevent anything from ever happening, be it a student-based situation or an intruder, parent-type situation. And so it's just making them very aware. But then if they end up in a situation, how best to respond?
Yeah. How is it, though, that you train a kindergartner to prepare for something like Sandy Hook?
Very carefully. Yeah, we don't, with the elementary kids, we might talk a little bit about it. It's just like, you know, stranger danger type conversation. You know, how do you can talk to them very carefully, but we do it so in a way that we don't put them in situations like where they necessarily train or send them through a scenario, anything of that nature. We're very careful with the delicate nature of the elementary kids. So the focus with the elementary is mostly with the teachers. As we get up into the middle school, we will involve them and include them a little more in the conversation. And then as we get to the high school, we include them in, you know, some of the students are actually included in the trainings and the drills of nature.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that could create a lot of anxiety.
Exactly.
For a young kid.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, to compare it, though, I mean, I'll date myself. I mean, I used to jump under the desk for an atomic
right.
bomb. The difference was that I didn't know what an atomic bomb was.
Right.
Kids know, understand what a shooter is.
Exactly. Yeah. They're a lot more familiar with it. So you can talk about it, but you definitely do not want to create fear, anxiety. The whole goal behind this is to actually create, you know, a little bit more peace about a situation and going to school and they feel safe. You don't want to create what could happen. You know, you want them to feel safe when they come to school.
Okay. Either of you, Shad's, like to mention anything else?
You mentioned that the board had been looking at the academic calendar. And we believe we have one in place that will be coming out the first of next week. They gave me some modifications. And then the other thing is we're working on our salary placement policy with faculty. And one of the things that we're trying to figure out is how do you take the current trend in education, which is kind of a step in lane for faculty, and school districts are wrestling with how many years of experience do they give to current faculty or to faculty that are coming in from other districts. And so the board is taking some time to really look at that issue carefully and wrestle with it, because we want to be in a position where we are not short on faculty hiring and we are getting the best faculty, but we need to be fair and consistent to our own current faculty and not cause that salary compression that has happened in the university system. And so it's an interesting topic that we'll be wrestling with and addressing in the upcoming months.
Okay. Have you guys got any lobbying plans at the state legislature?
I try and spend as much time there as possible, and then I'm involved with the Utah Superintendents Association, and they do a tremendous job as well as the Utah School Boards Association, and so we try and support those efforts and support the initiatives that will benefit education and students.
Yeah. You're optimistic, though, for funding this year?
We are, but we're concerned on how much of it will be put away into the rainy day fund, I personally believe in that, but I don't believe in jeopardizing the growth of education. And we've been told when the economy gets better, we will support education. And I hope our legislators will remember that promise.
Okay. Superintendent Shad Sorensen and High School Assistant Principal Shad Stevens, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:30. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Board of Education yesterday named Wendy Crossland to replace the unexpired term of school board member Petra Butler, who resigned at the end of 2018. In the studio to tell us more about that, as well as some other business, I have school board president Andrew Kaplan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see, the vote was 3-1 with newly elected board member Kara Hendrickson dissenting. Did she give any reason for that?
Yeah, it was actually a very difficult decision for all of us. We had 6 applicants who were all very highly qualified. We had actually a 7th applicant who wasn't able to participate because they lived across the street from the boundary. And as you know, the boundary maps are a little unclear, but it was certainly the most people who have applied or run in, you know, at least 5 or 6 years for a district spot. So we were very, very pleased. The dissenting vote was in favor of a candidate, Francis Fu, who was also an outstanding candidate. And, you know, I think the board made a decision in favor of Wendy for a number of reasons. She has a legal background. She's a teacher, obviously has a master's in education, has been an educator for a number of years, is a champion for equity, speaks fluent Spanish, and also very importantly, she has 2 children in high school. And if we look at creating a matrix of experiences and personal experiences, certainly, we don't have a board member currently with students in secondary school, and that was very important to us, especially as we're in the midst of master planning where there's going to be a lot of decisions made about the secondary schools. So we thought that she rounded out the board nicely, and we're excited to have her.
You were also reelected president. So are there term limits in terms of how long one can serve as president?
It's a good question. I hope so. Because I
think this is your, second or third year, huh?
This is my, so every election cycle, so every 2 years, we reelect leadership. And so I served for a year, and then I was reelected to serve for the next 2 years, which will run until my term expires. So, and then, you know, in 2 years' time, we'll do it again.
All right. Let's see. The school board also decided on a school calendar for next school year. The start date a couple of days earlier, August 20th. Mm-hmm. The end date is June 2nd. So is that graduation, that June 2nd?
I believe graduation is the 29th of May, but I'm not positive. The new calendar is on the website, so I think it's a couple days before June 2nd. It typically is a couple days before the last day of official school. This was a very late decision on the calendar. Ideally, we would have the calendar, you know, decided and published several years ahead of time. And that's a commitment we're going to make going forward to, you know, have at least 2 to 3 years out.
Yeah, these dates look weird, though. Maybe we're talking, are we talking this upcoming school year?
Yeah, so this is 2000.
June 2nd is a Sunday. Yeah, maybe I've just got this.
2019-20.
Yeah.
So it'll be 2020, right. Okay. June 2nd.
I need to look at it.
Which should
ahead.
Be, yeah.
Yeah, okay. In terms of the timeline for making calendar decisions from here on out, there was some criticism that you heard earlier from patrons. They want more time so that they can plan vacations and stuff.
Absolutely. Well, it's not just vacations. It's childcare. It's, you know, for our teachers and staff, it's figuring out, you know, childcare and things like that. So it's, you know, it's definitely something that needs to be at least a year or two out. Our goal is before the end of this school year to have the 2020 and 2021 calendars out there and published. There's a lot of different stakeholder input that we get. You know, there's an interest from the high school to have the school year start earlier. You know, a couple of the major factors there that we have high school athletics that start earlier than the first day of school. We also have AP exams in late May. And really to be able to break up the semester system for kids in Treasure and the high school so that their first semester is done with before Christmas break. So that, you know, right now or previously they were studying for finals and doing things over the break. And from a mental health perspective, it makes a lot more sense to have a clean, you know, a clean break there.
Right. And some kids, though, didn't like that. They liked the fact that they could have the extra couple of weeks to study. And I mean, are you just saying like father knows best in this case?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Our student board member, Stephen, was you know, one of those proponents of having the extra time to study and do work on finals and prepare. You know, our new principal, Roger Arbabi, was, you know, a proponent of having it end beforehand. I think a lot of the educators would prefer to end it beforehand so that there actually is a break. So similar to what happens in higher education and college, you know, you go to university and, you know, at the end of your semester, you take your exams and then you go home and you have a month to decompress. And I think it's the same type of principle where, you know, it gives kids a mental break as opposed to working throughout the Christmas and New Year season. So it's a, you know, there's pros and cons of both. You know, I think the debate will continue on and we'll continue to canvas stakeholders, including our students, our educators and our community to figure out what the best solution is for our calendar.
Okay. A presentation was made asking the school board to change the language arts offerings for high school students. So how will it change briefly from what we have?
Sure. So there's state mandated requirements for ELA for English language arts, and our teachers at the high school and our English department proposed a change where it's going to move a lot closer to what it looks like as electives in college. There will be, you know, traditionally there was a 10th grade English, a 10th grade honors English, an 11th grade English, you know, and then there's two APs. There's AP language and AP literature. And now there will be, I want to say, 12 or 15 different types of electives to take. There'll be certain ones that are required, such as a sophomore academy, to get kids who are entering high school up to speed with expectations and how to write and things like that. But there will really be a wider range of course choices. And the idea is to have kids engaged. Mr. Nagel, who was presenting, you know, was very clear about that, is that, you know, there's proof that when students are engaged, they're learning better. And so, you know, there's courses on Shakespeare, there's courses on graphic novels that are being proposed. And so there's something for everyone. There's also an AP track that continues, and there will be certain electives that, you know, are on that AP track. So we're not taking away any of the AP courses. We're not taking away, you know, things that existed before. We're just making them a little bit more interesting. And it's a, you know, it's an interesting experiment. The state school board came and met with the teachers and the high school, and they were very excited about the proposal as well. So.
All right. There'll be an informational meeting Tuesday, February 5th, 6 o'clock at Park City High School. That would be the time to bring any questions.
Absolutely.
And then what? This goes into effect for next school year?
Yes, this will be for next school year.
All right. There was also a discussion about blended classrooms in the elementary schools. What does that look like?
I think it was blended classrooms for ELA. And what that means is that instead of having a 10th grade English, 11th grade English, a lot of these courses are going to have 10th through 12th graders. And so, you know, that's something that is relatively new, certainly in the English department. But we think, well, the educators believe that that's going to be a positive learning experience. There'll be some mentoring from the older students to the younger students. So it's going to be a learning process for all of us. There's going to be a lot of work to be done by the teachers. I think it'll be an interesting experience for all of our students as well, and we'll see how it goes. You know, I think we're just encouraged that our educators are thinking outside the box and trying to do things to engage students.
All right. Let's see. Athletic Director Jamie Sheets made a lacrosse presentation outlining some of the anticipated cost of the district to sanction the boys and girls programs at the high school. Mm-hmm. How much are we talking about?
The conservative estimates of the highest possible number was around $100,000. And that's to get both programs off the ground. The operating costs going forward would be substantially lower. But there's, you know, a lot of equipment costs and travel costs. Travel is the main expense. And, you know, some of our trips would be 120 miles round trip to compete. So, you know, it's a similar type of expenditure to baseball and football. So it's on the more expensive side of programming for athletics. But it's a very popular sport in the community, and it's something that has been adopted statewide now, starting next school year for a varsity sport for both boys and girls.
Yeah, given that we have such a strong program, and I'm guessing there's really, I mean, of course we're going to do this, yeah?
Yeah, I think we're all supportive. I think the community is very supportive. And I think it's exciting as well from an equity perspective to have it be a sanctioned high school sport. So perhaps more children who are interested in the sport can participate than, you know, when it's a private club.
Yeah. Mr. Sheets also mentioned some other girl activities coming on to the sanctioned sports.
I believe cheer is going to be sanctioned potentially next year. You know, we already have a cheerleading program, so that's not new in terms of programming. And the other one is girls wrestling, which I also believe we currently have some competitors in. So there will be a change from it as far as it being recognized by the state. But we already have programming in both of those. So, you know, I would imagine that the programming will grow and there could be more participation, but it's not, neither of those are new to us as a community.
Okay. Noticed on the public school board meeting notices that the district is keeping recordings of school board meetings for only 1 year. When did that change? Or was that just, I mean, has that always been policy and it's just now being noticed?
I'm not sure, to be honest. That's news to me. I know that we have... you know, all of our meetings recorded and videoed and on board docs. And I'll have to check on that, to be honest. I think it may be an issue of bandwidth and keeping all of the data, but that's news to me.
Yeah, I guess I just hadn't noticed it on the sheet that we get from the state. So last week, district leadership made a decision to keep school open with the storm. Whose decision is that? Is it the superintendent's?
That's the superintendent's decision.
Yeah.
You know, that's made by, you know, obviously speaking to the transportation director, you know, and ultimately it's about the safety of the children and whether or not, you know, it's safe to run the buses and get kids to school. And the superintendent, along with the transportation director and the business administrator, sit down and make that decision early in the morning.
So is there any leeway then just to start school later in order to give the plows a chance to clear
some of the
roads?
I believe there is. We do have a late start protocol. We also make it very clear that, you know, when there is heavy storms, that it's the parents' option whether or not to bring their children to school late or keep them at home if they don't believe that they're safe. So from that perspective, it's, you know, we're trying to offer as much flexibility while keeping our schools open.
Well, I had heard reports of significant absenteeism. I mean, there was one class with 5 kids in it. I mean, I guess if we're in the business of educating classes, maybe we should just rethink that. I mean, given that, I mean, if we're not teaching kids.
Yeah, I think there's a number of factors. I mean, Friday was a huge snow day. You know, it was a big ski day, and it was also the front end of a long weekend. And so I think it was kind of the, you know, an obvious scenario where you're going to have a ton of absences, a lot of kids headed to the mountain, and a lot of kids unable to travel and get home. So I think that's something we should be reviewing. You know, I think one of the great things here is that we have such great plowing and municipal services that you know, the norm is for us to be operating as a community, as opposed to in other communities in the East Coast, for example, where you have a ton of snow days, or in California. So we're, you know, I think we'll continue to look at that, but, you know, our goal is to keep keep school open if possible.
Yeah. I mean, we do have snow days built into the calendar. We could have easily closed it and had it made up some other day in the spring.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had, I think, one snow day in 20 years, and that was last year or the year before. I can't remember exactly when it was. And it's funny, you know, when we do close schools, you know, you get a wave of complaints as well because it creates issues with childcare and things like that. And so it's a tough decision. You know, again, it comes down to the administration and whether or not they think that it's safe for the buses to travel and kids to get to school. But, yeah.
But we also got to consider teacher safety, no? I mean, because I know we have teachers from Provo area who couldn't get through because of the avalanche mm-hmm. on the road, and then lots from the Salt Lake Valley as well, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's, you know, that's one of the considerations, and it's something that, you know, in the morning, I think the call is made around 4 or 4:30. You know, that's what, you know, you get up, you see how the bus depot looks, you see how the roads are, you check UDOT, you find out if the canyons are open or if they're not, and all of those are inputs that go into the decision.
Finally, I just wanted to ask you about the quarterly meeting between the Summit County Council, Park City Council, and the Park City Board of Education. Is that something you attended?
Yes.
Yeah. The superintendent apparently listed off her top 5 accomplishments. Do you recall what those were?
I don't recall offhand. You know, I can certainly get those to you, but, you know, there were accomplishments for the first 6 months and kind of where we stood, in terms of an update, you know, where we are in master planning, where we are in terms of, achievements. You know, one of them was some accolades, you know, being recognized again as, top school in Utah, you know, for the high school and top district, et cetera. So it was just kind of an update, you know, in terms of our accolades, where we were in master planning, things like that.
So are these meetings open to the public?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, they're posted, you know, they're meant to be quarterly. We had some discussion because we haven't had one in probably 6 or 9 months about moving them to be semi-annually. And I think that's probably more likely with the potential for one, you know, in the interim, if there's some big news going on. You know, we as a school board meet regularly with both the city and the county, probably on a monthly basis, to have a catch up about what's going on. And that, you know, includes things about our plans. It includes things about, you know, municipal road improvements, projects like that. So, you know, when we talk about the Acker Park and Ride with the county, or we talk about the road works on 224 with the city, we do that on a regular basis. And then this quarterly meeting is a public forum where we can all get together and talk as a full board. Obviously, when we're meeting with the individual entities, we're only meeting, you know, 2 board members to 2 board members along with administration.
So it's not official quorums?
So those are not quorums or public meetings. And we have the ability to talk about real estate and different projects that we're working on.
Okay. And then don't have to keep minutes or any recordings.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. It's a less official meeting. And then these quarterly ones will be semi-annually, will be, you know, public, open to everyone to come and ask questions and to observe.
Okay. Next meeting is scheduled for April 15th, I think you decided.
Yep.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I mean, the only thing I would mention is, you know, we recently attended the Utah State Board Association's annual meeting. The board was recognized as a recipient of the Master Board Award, which means that, you know, we all achieve the training goals set out by the state standards. And that's something that the community has asked us to make sure that we're focused on training and professional development. And we've accomplished that for the first time. In many years. So we're looking forward to keeping that up.
Okay. Andrew, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Park City School Board President Andrew Kaplan. KPCW News Time now, 8:47. The Sundance Film Festival, of course, kicking off Thursday with another slate of documentary films. 16 of them are in the U.S. competition. Others come from around the globe in studio with a preview of this year's documentary program. I have one of the programmers, Harry Vaughn. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning.
So, looking at the program, you could say it's about sex, drugs, and rock and roll here in the U.S. film. We've got Dr. Ruth, Michael Jackson, and David Crosby, just to highlight a few. How would you sum up the this year's nonfiction films?
Well, I like your summation quite a bit, actually. No, it's funny. These are a lot of portrait films that we've been showing at Sundance recently. We used to call them biopics, but we've been having conversations in the programming room about how these type of movies about famous people aren't so much hagiographies. They're about using them in order to understand something deeper, you know, how they relate to history, the time in which they were famous, and the times we're living in now. And so I think when you talk about a film like Crosby, Remember My Name, about David Crosby from Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that's the kind of film you're looking at. It's not just about him as a famous rock star. It doesn't just check off all those music doc, bio doc tropes. It's one of the most personal, kind of naked interview films I've ever seen, with David Crosby just laying everything on the line about his life.
Being a jerk, too.
Oh, being a total jerk sometimes, admitting to it, admitting to relationships in which he totally screwed up, and really realizing that there's certain things at his age he can't fix, and having to come to terms with that. And that kind of vulnerability just stunned us. You know, this is a very famous man who's done so well for himself. He could have found a way to craft a film that was very hagiographic and very positive about him, but he decided to stick with the truth.
Yeah, because that's not what I walked away with, but I think I love your perspective of that. I was kind of like, I used to like this guy.
Oh, really? Well, varying opinions are very important to this festival.
Yeah. In terms of what you watched then to make this program happen, I mean, how many did you sit through?
Oh, gosh. I watched, I think, over 400 films, and a lot of them for the entirety. I think people they have a misconception that programmers watch the first 5 minutes and turn it off, but we get scared about missing things, especially in documentary films where a kind of a blockbuster revelation can happen 20 minutes in, so you really got to stick with it. So we've watched quite a few films.
Yeah. Any film in particular that you as a programmer pushed to make sure was included? I mean, it's, lots of times there's consensus, but sometimes I think you have to stand up for...
Yeah. Gosh. There was one film that I loved called The Disappearance of My Mother, which is playing in the World Documentary Competition. And it's about a woman who was quite famous in Italy, Benedetta Barzini, who was a model. And then she became a critic of the fashion industry. And her son, who's a filmmaker, wants to make a movie about her. But the one thing she can't stand anymore is the camera. And so there's this huge confrontation between mother and son about how to capture her in a way that she wants. And I felt really passionately about that film because there's such a beautiful mother-son relationship at its core. And I really want people to feel the love like I did in that film.
Yeah. Looking at the films in the U.S. competition, those 16, I mean, those get put there. I mean, how is that? How are they chosen to be in the competition?
You know, there's another preconception that people often have, and rightly so, that we program based on preset themes that we want going into a season. But one of the most beautiful things about programming for Sundance is these themes arrive organically as we're watching these movies. One of the themes that you pointed out is that profile theme of these famous people getting interviewed and revealing parts of their lives that tell a story deeper than themselves. But we've also noticed that there's a lot of films this year that are about nascent political movements or political movements from the past that have shaped what we're looking at right now, what our landscape is. And that came through with quite a few films in our lineup, both in U.S. and in world.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you separate the competition films from the premiere documentaries?
That is such a good question. Well, first, the easiest way to separate them is if the filmmaker is Alex Gibney, and he has a great film called Inventor, and we want to show it. And that's a perfect place for Alex Gibney because he is so seasoned and so successful and doing quite well in the documentary sphere. So premieres is where it's at for someone like him of his caliber.
So you try to keep the competition films as sort of first-timers?
We like the idea of competition being a fresh new look at a fresh voice.
Yeah. Certainly some documentaries that have come from Sundance have had major impact and change. Anything that stands out for you in terms of the most impactful of this year's lineup?
You mean of 2018? Mm-hmm. Or of this year?
Yeah.
What could be?
Yeah.
Gosh, that's so hard to tell. I mean, we had a great year at Sundance last year. And in retrospect, you can see what the big films ended up being. You know, Won't You Be My Neighbor, RBG, Minding the Gap. It's so hard to know right now what those films will be. but I can talk about some films that I think might be pretty hot.
Yeah, go ahead.
Where's My Roy Cohn, directed by Matt Tiernauer, about the pretty intense and sordid, scathingly delicious is what David calls it, history of Roy Cohn and America. You know, he began his career with Joseph McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings, and his last project was Donald Trump, and he really helped create a language that is still being utilized today. So I think that film is going to generate a lot of buzz and conversation. Matt Tiernauer was with us last year with Studio 54, which was such a fun look at the decadent past, and this is a darker and more incisive look.
Mm-hmm. I mean, did he kind of jump on this at once Donald Trump was elected? I mean, or
did Matt jump on it?
Yeah.
Gosh, I think this has been a project he's been working on for more than a couple years. And even in the film Studio 54, he plays a supporting player. So I think Matt's had his eye on Roy for some time.
Okay, what else?
Let's see, what else we got? Looking through. Mike Wallace is here, is a terrific portrait of one of the 60 Minutes founders, Mike Wallace, who created a new form of journalism. And I think what this film kind of looks at is how successful was that at the time, how impactful is it now, and did he do more good than bad, or by turning journalism into entertainment, have we now arrived at this place of cacophony and disorder in the newsroom. He's such a charismatic man, Mike Wallace, and it's all archival footage. So you really kind of have to choose for yourself.
The guy that just stood in front of your face and didn't let you walk away.
Yeah. He was relentless. I mean, it was cringeworthy sometimes, but then he would, you know, blow up a huge story.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about some of the world documentaries? I know I've got some friends that live here from Macedonia. They've got a film there, Honeyland.
Gosh, Honeyland. That is one of those films that makes me so happy to be a programmer, because those are just one of those discoveries out of Macedonia that seem to come out of left field, but are such beautiful stories. This is about a woman in a practically abandoned village in Macedonia who is one of the world's best beekeepers, and I think one of the last who does it in this purely organic way. 50% she leaves for the bees, 50% she takes to sell. But this is interrupted by a really raucous family that moves in, and they start borrowing her techniques, and she happily teaches them, but then they start destroying her techniques, and it's about her survival and the bees' survival, based on this, you know, family coming in and disrupting everything. I wouldn't miss it.
Sea of Shadows, I get to see a screener of that. And again, this is like one of those things you love about documentaries where you learn something that you had no idea about. And this is about the vaquita, and it's near extinction. Do you recall that one?
Yeah, it's near extinction because of a huge underground trade system that I had no idea about between China and Mexico. They're capturing a different type of fish for this market, but in capturing that fish, they're killing that whale that you mentioned, that small whale, the vaquita, and destroying an ecosystem in the process. This film kind of reminds me of a smorgasbord of environmental documentaries that we've shown before, in that it mixes activism with, you know, intense journalistic pursuit. So it's a real thrill ride.
Yeah, that was a real interesting one, because it was like one of the reporters. It was like, you know, and it wasn't the government. I mean, it was the reporter that was driving the story.
That's right. And yeah. It was a name brand reporter, too. Mm-hmm. Someone who had a lot at stake in pursuing this story.
Yeah. In terms of kind of looking ahead, I mean, who are the documentaries going to be of tomorrow going to feature?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we kind of looking at Mike Wallace and Apollo 11 this year. When you kind of look ahead even 5 years, I mean, any ideas for what those topics would be?
That is the beauty of programming, is I can tell you honestly, I have no idea. I'm as in the dark as you are. I just have those precious 3 months where we're watching 10 films a day and we're learning who those people are. I think that's the power of documentary, is it's brewing a zeitgeist right before your eyes.
Yeah. And I know you programmers hate to pick a favorite, but do you have something that's just kind of near and dear to your heart?
I do hate to pick a favorite.
Well, let's say it's not a favorite, just something that you just, you know, if you don't see it during Sundance, that, you know what, put it on your list of things to
see. I know what it
is.
Yep. It's American Factory, and it's in our U.S. documentary competition. It's directed by Julia Reichert and Steven Bognar, and it is just one heck of a story. It's about a shuttered Dayton, Ohio factory that is purchased by a Chinese billionaire. And his idea, his experiment, is to bring 50% of his workforce from China to work with the locals who are getting rehired in that factory. So it's about watching, it's a real microcosm of watching two completely different cultures and also two powerhouse economies trying to work together. And things get very, very complicated. It's an epic, one of those American epics that I just would not miss.
Okay, Harry, thanks for sharing some of your insights.
No, thank you so much.
Harry Vaughn again with Sundance Programming.